Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. Stories from the road. There's always been a quiet debate amongst drivers, whether they are long-haul truckers, traveling salesmen, charter bus drivers, and the like, or just people who travel a lot, as to what region of this country has the weirdest shit happen on their roads or just off of them in some cases. Be the occurrences super or extra-natural in origin, ghosts, phantasms, serial killers, wendigos, or just plain run-of-the-mill psychopathic, sociopathic, douche canoes that have nothing better to do with their lives other than fuck with other people. Sadly, the latter is far too prevalent. But I digress. You came here for a story, not a soliloquy. I will apologize in advance, as this is not a trucker story, but a story told to me by a friend who drove a bus route for over 15 years. I hope you enjoy it. Marcus just retired at the ripe young age of 46 from a certain company whose slogan might have asked its patrons to leave the driving to us, with a distinguished 28 years. He started as a ticket clerk and eventually got his Class B license and became a driver. He retired as a regional administrator for the southeastern U.S. It's in this area the story takes place. I was doing my loop route at the time from New Orleans to Atlanta, Atlanta to Nashville and Memphis, then Memphis back down to New Orleans, stopping at all points in between. Now, you may know that New Orleans has a culture steeped in the occult and is a large service industry and tourism town to boot. So when I say I get all kinds on my bus, you better believe it. On this particular run, I had everything from nuns, students, and soldiers to party burnouts, retirees, and people transitioning to new places for new lives. I was raised a good Catholic boy, so I made sure the sisters had good seats for certain. I apologize for my preferential treatment, but growing up in an orphanage, these women were basically my moms, and who doesn't treat their mama right? Marcus is indeed a very religious man and doesn't swear. He endearingly refers to them by their first initials and won't even come close to uttering a goddammit, which is sacrilege for him. So I'll be supplying the color translation to his commentary of the events that took place. So, I have the sisters up front along with a young lady. They tell me he's traveling with them to the Mercy Convent just outside Savannah, Georgia, where she is to begin training, changing buses in Atlanta. When I asked the young lady if she was excited to serve the Lord, she shied away, and I got a stern admonishment from the highest-ranking sister there. Sir, Vanessa has taken a vow of silence until her ceremony of commitment. Please refrain from speaking to her, as she may be tempted to break that vow. Vanessa hung her head a bit, and I felt immediately guilty. But that's all a part of being Catholic. I thanked the sister for her guidance and suggested they settle in since it was a 14-hour trip from New Orleans to Atlanta. There were several stops in town and on the outskirts of town before we hit the open road, so everyone was still talkative and lively around 10 p.m. when we crossed over to Mississippi on the I-55 northbound. You folks might not know why riding on a bus cross-country is so affordable, so I'll briefly explain. Most bus services hit just about any little old town that's not too terribly far off any given route, thus turning what by car might be a 4 or 5 hour drive into a 14 to 20 hour odyssey by bus, mainly because instead of traveling directly on the major highways, many routes follow parallel to them on rural routes and country roads, depending. I've done it several times myself, and it's a great way to meet interesting people for sure. Sorry again for interrupting. We were about halfway to Jackson when the disturbances began. People were complaining of a faint smell of rotten eggs or of flies on the bus. I could only assure them that this bus, according to the maintenance logs, which I willingly displayed for them along stops, was clean 2 hours prior to their coming on board. I'm a bit of a stickler for cleanliness and made sure my bus was one of, if not the cleanest in the fleet. One of our internal mottos is, take pride in your ride. And I most certainly did. There was a bit of a drive after our last pickup and our first major stop in Jackson, so people had time to settle in and fall asleep, including the sisters escorting young Vanessa. She was humming a tune I wasn't familiar with and gently rocking back and forth. I could see this in the small parabolic mirror I have on the dash to give a view of the passenger cabin so I can keep an eye out for anyone pulling shenanigans. The distortion of the curved surface of the mirror made her eyes look bigger than they were, and her head misshapen. It was an unnerving effect. I was about to pick up the mic to quietly announce our imminent arrival into the city of Jackson when something in my mirror caught my eye and gave me pause. Vanessa had turned around in her seat and was staring at something towards the back of the bus. I couldn't turn my head that far to look and still keep my eyes safely on the road at the same time, so I kept a watchful eye in snippets. She seemed to be pointing at someone and then beckoning them to her. But as far as I could tell in the darkened bus, everyone back that way was asleep. I politely turned my head and said, "Miss, please turn around and be seated. We'll be entering the city shortly." I think I saw her make a face at me in the mirror, but I'm not sure. I picked up the mic and announced 5 minutes until Jackson arrival. In Jackson, the couple sitting behind the nuns and Vanessa approached me as I was assisting a porter with the loading and unloading of baggage. "Sir, could you maybe make an announcement to the bus before we leave in regards to trash and food or something? Someone in our area has a rotten ham salad sandwich or something, and it's making my wife nauseous. It'll be greatly appreciated." I told them I'd make an announcement of sorts, and in the meantime, if they wanted to reboard the bus at this time, there may be open seats in a section away from the source of the smell. I went to the terminal manager and asked if he could have someone from sanitation personnel take a walk through the bus to ascertain the source. With no passengers on the bus, it was an easy sweep that came up negative. There were no foul odors. If anything, the sanitation clerk complained that the New Orleans crew had used the fresh scent spray a bit too liberally. I announced boarding, and the couple were the first on the bus, making a beeline for the rear of the bus. It was about 2 a.m. when we finally departed the terminal and people were beat and tired. The bus fell almost immediately to silence, with the exception of the elder sister who snored like a lumberyard. Nobody stirred except for Vanessa. Call it the vibrance of youth or nervous energy over starting a new life, she was wide awake, looking around the cabin. I knew from when I came back on board and the safety lights were still on that there were no passengers in the last two rows, but she kept staring back there. She would occasionally giggle and resumed humming. At one point, I heard a low murmur, too deep to be Vanessa, but coming from her vicinity. The noise ceased at once as one of the nuns stirred and asked Vanessa if she needed to use the restroom. They made their way back, and as far as I can tell, the nun went in with her. This was odd to me, but I'm not 100% sure on how they operate. They were in there for a good 3 to 5 minutes as far as I can reckon. I have to keep my eyes on the road if I want to keep my safe driver bonus. So admittedly, time got away from me. When the door opened, I could barely tell what was going on back there, but it appeared that the nun pointed to the front of the bus, and Vanessa returned to her seat, to the sleeping elder. She looked like she was finally settling in. The nun that went into the bathroom did not come back up, but seemed to have disappeared into one of the two empty rear rows. Nobody voluntarily sits next to the bathroom, unless they want privacy or are up to no good. And this was a nun, so I opted to believe in the former. I noticed that Vanessa had lain her head down on the shoulder of the elder nun and appeared to be fast asleep. I caught a whiff of a rotten egg-like smell, and that murmuring from before started again. This time, I still couldn't make out words, but it sounded like a chant of sorts, deep and foreboding. I remembered seeing a sign reading Granada 1 mile. We didn't have a stop here, but it's where I pick up Rural Route 8 to head over towards Tupelo, birthplace of Elvis Aaron Presley, the king. Marcus cleared his throat and sat up a bit straighter in his seat. When we hit the town limit of Granada, all hell, both literally and figuratively, broke loose. With a jolt, the elder nun sat up with a most ungodly scream, like her insides had been lit afire. She started tearing at her clothes and saying things no woman, let alone a nun, should utter. "Dear God, forgive the whore. I've lain with men. I've tasted the flesh of cocks and cunts alike. I've played with my nipples during Mass. I licked Sister Marie's asshole on a dare when I was 23. I stole from my parents and burned their shed to the ground. Dear God, please forgive this filthy whore. I thought I was going to wreck the bus. Here's this nun, a woman of God, tearing off her clothes and exposing herself and confessing her every sin to the world. I was terrified. Next thing I know, she lurched forward, grabbed the door lever and wrenched it open, and with inhuman strength, she threw herself from the bus in a swan dive at 55 miles per hour. I swerved to the left, as I didn't want to run the poor woman under the tires, and stood on the brakes. I sat there for a moment, my hands shaking in their death grip on the wheel. I looked out into the blackness, I, the confused muttering of the other passengers, and laughing? I looked for the source of the laughter. I found it in the maniacally grinning face of Vanessa. I'm ashamed to say, I was not the first person out of the bus to check on the nun. One of the young soldiers aboard was a combat medic. He rushed to assess the damage. I did manage to get on my radio and contact the authorities and an ambulance. I stepped out of the bus and approached the still, naked form of the elder nun. The soldier had rolled her over to perform first aid, but we could tell it was too late for her. She landed in such a way that the vast majority of her face and breast had been scraped away by her impact with the road surface. Her palms and forearms were free of abrasions. She hadn't even attempted to stop her dive towards death. The police took statements and took photos. When I explained that the nun had been sitting next to the young girl, the police were unable to find her. Vanessa had slipped away in the confusion. We found the other nun in the rear of the bus, huddled in the darkness, her eyes and tongue missing. An autopsy later revealed the missing organs in her own stomach. She'd torn them out and swallowed them. The only trace of Vanessa were bare, bloody footprints leading from the bus to woods on the sides of the road. Two things are certain from that night. They never found that girl, and I believe in my God even more now. Another tale from the road. Road rage has always been something that has boggled my imagination. Here you are hurtling down a road, 50, 60, 80 miles an hour in some cases, and everyone is in a big-ass hurry to get somewhere. And how fucking dare you get in my lane at this precise moment? It's insanity. I've been guilty of it myself a time or two. But when I say mine might be a little more justified than yours, hear me out. A fully loaded semi typically weighs in the vicinity of 80,000 pounds. That's about 38 metric tons for my readers anywhere but the U.S. Now, this same semi traveling at highway speeds, 55 to 75 miles per hour, depending on your location, requires at least the length of 3 football fields to come to a safe and complete stop. This is in optimal conditions of sunshine and dry, flat roadways. Still, people feel the need to play chicken with a fully loaded rig by cutting us off and stopping short in front of us. I was traveling down I-43 from Green Bay, Wisconsin, to a railway in Chicago carrying a load of 10-foot paper rolls that weighed a total of 44,000 pounds. I did this run sometimes twice a day if it was just timed right and I didn't hit any major traffic snarls. I usually preferred to drive at night because there's less traffic, and that was the case this time around. Let's be honest. If you've ever driven through the Chicago or Milwaukee areas, the best time to do so is around 3 a.m. It's enough time for the majority of the drunks to have weaved their ways home from the bars, and rush hour doesn't start for another 3 hours or so. If you've never done it at this hour, I suggest you give it a try. It's rather nice. I was just passing Kohler, Wisconsin, and if you're thinking that name sounds vaguely familiar, it should. Take a look at your bath or kitchen fixtures. they might have Kohler emblazoned across them. It's what's used to be referred to as a company town, where a manufacturer, mine, or lumber company founded a town for whatever reason of the location and whatnot. I only mention the town because this is where the insanity started. I had pulled off the highway and into a truck stop just outside Kohler. It was between 1:30 and 2 a.m., and aside from the trucks that were parked there overnight and the attendants, there was only two other people there. One was a morbidly obese woman in what I can only guess is a lavender muumuu. She was cruising the candy aisle, and it appeared that her ample backside had devoured a good portion of the garment. Yes, I shudder to think about that. The other was a guy of about my age, height, and build. He looked so much like me, in my opinion, that it was a little unnerving. It wasn't just me. The girl at the counter looked from me to him and back. You guys brothers or something? I shook my head and paid for my purchases. I was about to leave when I saw the guy staring at me. I didn't like the look he was giving me, so I got out of there and climbed back in my truck. I made sure to lock the doors as the guy followed me out and slid into maybe a Ford Taurus or a Honda Accord. I can't recall. And just sat there. I waited for the guy to leave first, but he didn't go anywhere until I did. I'm a supremely suspicious person to begin with. Having been raised by a federal employee who was paranoid about his employer and having that government conspiracy crap force-fed to me for 18 years. Couple with that one of the symptoms of PTSD called hypervigilance, and you've got a cocktail for cuckoo puffs. Okay, maybe this guy wasn't looking at me like he wanted to eat my children, but he set off my spidey senses when he pulled out of the lot right behind me and then onto the highway, where he could have passed me at any time since my shitty company truck was governed at 63 miles per hour. That's right, kids. I couldn't even go speed limit if I wanted to. This guy couldn't be following me. I mean, unless he was trying to draft off my trailer and save himself a few miles per gallon. I pulled off the next exit and he followed me. I drove straight through at the intersection to the other ramp and back onto the highway, and this guy still followed me. What the fuck? Was this guy looking to rob me or jack my load? He was going to be supremely disappointed when he discovered he just robbed someone for a couple of giant rolls of paper instead of some truck headed for a Best Buy warehouse. I figured that my best bet would be to just keep driving and ignore the guy. If I was rolling, he'd have a hard time trying anything. So that's just what I did. The guy just sat there in my rear view for the next 40 miles, changing lanes when I did, never exceeding 63 miles per hour. When we got closer to Milwaukee, his behavior changed. He pulled up alongside my cab and just rode right there for a few miles, and then in front of me, where he took his foot off the gas. I just changed lanes, but so did he. What's this guy thinking? He's going to get me to stop? I finally got by him when I stopped using my turn signals. He couldn't anticipate my movements. He sped up to get out ahead of me, so I took the next exit unannounced and he couldn't get over to follow me in time. I took a couple of turns off the highway as quickly as my size and mass would safely allow and parked, calming myself. I kicked myself thinking, why didn't you call the cops, dumbass? I knew the area, but I wanted to get this load down to Chicago before the assholes, well, the other assholes hit the road. I made my way back to the highway and continued on south. There was still little to no cars on the road, so I got my rig back up to speed and settled in for the ride. I passed what I thought was a car broken down on the side of the highway until its lights blazed on and it roared to life onto the highway. My first thought was that it was unmarked highway patrol, and I glanced down at my speedometer, stupidly. I couldn't speed through a 65-mile-per-hour zone, not unless there was a downhill, which it wasn't. No flashing lights, no signaling me of any sort. The car just settled in behind me. Then it dawned on me. Oh man, not this motherfucker again. This time, I grabbed my Bluetooth headset and dialed 911. They answered on the second ring. 911, what is your emergency? Hi, ma'am. I'm not sure if it's exactly an emergency, to be honest, But I'm a truck driver and I've had the same vehicle follow and harass me for the last 40 miles. I got off the highway and thought I lost him a ways back, but he was waiting for me on the berm and he's at it again. What's your location and cell number, sir? I gave her both. I have a state highway patrol car about 4 miles south of you, and I'll be dispatching them in your direction, sir. Just keep calm and continue driving safely. I'll stay with you until the officer has reached your location. I thanked her, and it seemed my harasser picked that moment to come up alongside me again. He's moving up again. I think he may try to get me to stop again. She remained calm. Sir, whatever you do, do not stop for that vehicle. Exasperated, I shouted, what the fuck am I supposed to do? Hit him? He's in front of me again. This time he slammed on his brakes, and I nearly rear-ended him, but swerved into another lane and got around him, which isn't the easiest thing to do when you weigh 80,000 pounds. I was describing what was going on to the 911 dispatcher, and I'm pretty sure I sounded a bit terrified because she was telling me to remain calm. Lady, this guy is actively attempting to run me off the road. I got back up to 63, but up ahead flashed the signs to slow down for a 45-mile-per-hour curve coming into the Milwaukee metro area. The speed listed on signs like that is a guideline for cars, meaning that I need to slow even further. Now, I'm not sure if this guy didn't see the warning sign or if he didn't care, because as we were coming up to the curb, he was passing me on the right at what I guessed to be 70 miles an hour. He was maybe 150 feet into the curb ahead of me when he locked up his brake and yanked the wheel to the left, which didn't make any sense in retrospect in a right-hand turn. The result was instant and catastrophic. It was almost as if the world slowed to 1/8 its regular speed. The vehicle seemed to cease all forward movement as left rear corner lifted into the air and its tires left the ground. I dropped out of gear and stood on my brakes as hard as I could. I had just come out of the curve, but I still had to worry about the trailer coming around on me. The bottom of the car loomed ahead of me as it continued its rotation, now no more than 20 feet from my front bumper. I flicked my eyes to my side mirrors. My trailer was still straight behind me, so I focused forward again, as the car had now made almost one full rotation through the air. I saw the driver and his eyes seemed to bore into me, his face without expression. And then he rotated out of sight again as the car rolled 3 more times, the world returning to real time as I finally came to a halt. The car resting on its roof about 10 feet from my front, driver's side bumper. I threw the truck in reverse so I could see the car from a safe distance. About a quarter mile ahead on the other side of the concrete barrier, the flashing red and blue of the state trooper's car came into view. He came screeching to stop and exited his vehicle. Sir, are you still there? I'd completely forgotten the dispatcher was still on the phone with me. Yeah, I'm here. I'm okay. The car. I couldn't find words. Sir, the officer should be on the scene now. Do you want me to stay on the line? I let her go and turned my attention to the cop, hopping over the barrier as 2 more patrol cars came roaring around the curve and came to stop on either side of my rig. I realized my hands were still in a death grip on the wheel. I pulled them away. My arms were on fire. I put the parking brake on and opened my door. Sir, please stay in the vehicle until we secure the scene. A Milwaukee cop hollered to me from the rear driver's side of my trailer. I left the door, but stayed where I was. The trooper had jogged to the overturned vehicle and was flashing his flashlight inside. He stood up, turned in a careful circle, looking confused, and then came toward my truck. Sir, did you see which way the driver went? I'm sorry, what? The driver of the car. He directed his beam on the vehicle. Did you see which way he went? My brain was still trying to understand what the hell he was asking me. I didn't see anyone get out. What are you talking about? There's no one in the car, sir. I let that sink in for a second. Officer, that car wasn't driving itself. As he walked away, he held up a finger telling me to wait where I was, and he conferred with the other police officers as I heard the wail of other sirens rushing to the crash. The cops spread out, one of them getting in his car, turning around and driving the wrong way on the highway until he was just out of sight around the curve and turned around, the alley lights on his cruiser shining into the grass on the side of the road as he drove at a snail's pace, searching for signs of an injured driver. I saw an ambulance and a full crew on a fire truck arrive along with more patrol vehicles to direct all traffic that would be coming into the two lanes furthest to the right. I seemed to have been forgotten as the officers searched for the driver of the car. I called my night freight dispatcher and told her what was going on, followed by a chorus of "oh shit" and "what the fucks" from the other dispatchers and their immediate supervisor in the background. They told me to sit tight and update them when the cops gave me more info. They'd informed the paper mill that their load was going to be late to the rail yard and scheduled a new drop time when they knew what was going on. Finally, two of the cops came up to my vehicle to talk to me. One was a state trooper who'd been first on the scene. They performed a breathalyzer test on me that came up with zero, as expected. They asked to search my vehicle for anything like narcotics, which I consented to. This was all standard shit after an accident. They inspected my vehicle for damage top to bottom. There was none to be found, as I'd had the good fortune to miss the car entirely. It was registered to a guy in Kohler, but they were unable to reach the owner. We sat there for hours, going over everything, and when a wrecker finally showed up to retrieve the damaged car, they attached the cable to the car to get it flipped over to its wheels, but when it rolled onto its side, the trunk flew open and something thumped to the ground, out of my line of view. The cop closest to the recovery driver yelled for him to stop as he approached what had fallen out of the trunk. "Aw, fuck," was all I heard him say, but his face spoke volumes of revulsion. He walked over to his patrol car and grabbed a white plastic folded sheet and draped it over the back of the car, obscuring any view of what had been in there. I was given back my IDs and my report that it had been taken. I was told I could leave the scene and that they'd contact me if they needed any information. As I slowly pulled away, I glanced the direction of the sheet and saw a brownish-red ooze like substance seeping out from under it. I never heard from the cops for more information. And another tale from the road. I spent my entire driving career spinning wheels for the big boys, the large companies you see on the highway on your commute to and from work every day, the ones you give the middle finger and call that little "how's my driving number" on when they didn't see you trying to encroach on their blind spot like an idiot. There are, as I've mentioned before, a lot of jobs out there for owner-operators who are willing to take a job that would be less than savory to your average driver. Meet Frank, or as he says, "The fuck do I care if you use my real goddamn name for? Call me Aladdin. Maybe one of those lady readers will rub my lamp and make a wish." I didn't have the heart to tell him that it was the genie in the lamp and not Aladdin. As you might have guessed, Frank is a bit on the crass and crude side, but I have to admit, he's hilarious in his own way. Frank told me once that he'd been a driver for one of those traveling carnivals back in the late 70s and early 80s. He loved it. All he had to do was drive the truck, and occasionally, when one of the barkers was sick or fired or disappeared, as often happened in a community as transient as a traveling carnival, he'd stand in for them, running games or rides. I went along with whatever because I was in it for the money and to be with my girlfriend at the time, Natasha. She was from Bulgaria, and believe you me, you haven't lived until you've banged a contortionist. It's like having a threesome with one broad. When she can lick, I told Frank that was enough of that, and asked him for the weirdest shit he'd seen as a carny. "Oh, brother, you have no idea what you're asking for. But you also gotta ask yourself, what is your definition and threshold for what you call weird? I mean, do you consider a guy sitting down the bench from you at dinner, tearing into a fish that's still kicking weird? To me, that's just Larry. What's weird for me is clowns. I'm not afraid of them, or nothing, but those bastards give me the creeps. It's just certain clowns that give me the cold sweats. Ever since Patton Oswalt said something about Scarlett Johansson's face on the body of a clown with chainsaws for tits, I haven't been able to get that image out of my spank bank. I got a rager in the Home Depot power tool department the other day, and it's a problem. And fuck you for judging what's in my repertoire of self-loving. For all I know, you like to be spanked with dead cats by bearded bikers with alternate personalities named Margaret while wearing a latex thong. So yeah, clowns. There was this guy, never knew his real name, but he was the first clown I'd seen that had more than two different faces. I'm not saying it right. He changed his face every day. Or his, what do you call it, routine or performance, whatever it is. One day, he'd be one of those Italian-looking clowns with a little white hat on his head. The next, he'd look like Bozo the fucking clown. One time he dressed up as an old-school hobo clown that you see in the black and white movies. That was my favorite because it reminded me of my childhood. So, this clown is different every day. He'd repeat a few faces and costumes or mix and match them, but for the most part, he changed. I guess he bothered me because I never saw what the guy looked like under the makeup. At least, I don't think I did. There's a lot I didn't know about this cat, and I'm not entirely sure anybody did. Natasha said she was pretty sure he was queer, because you never saw him with a woman. But I never saw him with a man either, so who's to say? We were in Pennsylvania for a week or two, on the outskirts of a town called Pottstown. I remember the beer I was swimming in Yingling. Some local yokels working as part-timers would bring cases of the stuff to hang out after the carnival closed for the night. Clowny McChangey Face never joined in our reindeer games, but you could see him skulking about here and there. One of the yokels started making eyes at Natasha one night, so I told him to shove off and find his own girl, which apparently he did. I saw him stumbling off with some redhead later on. I didn't recognize her, so I assumed she was a townie. Next morning, the police were knocking on my Natasha's trailer's door, asking me questions about this guy, saying, "We were told you had a confrontation with him, and then bam, we have his corpse in the morgue." I about shit. Whoa, 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 whoa. I didn't lay a hand on this guy. I was with my lady all night, never left her side. Natasha told him the same. I did tell him about the redhead I saw the guy leaving with, though, and they seemed to take that at face value. A few days later, I saw the same redhead with another guy, one of our roadies, Tommy, that always set up the equipment and ran one of the rides. The next morning, the boss man hits me up to run Tommy's ride like I'd done numerous times before for other guys. I get to thinking, what if this is what's been going on? What if we've got a killer following us around? Disappearing people and the yokel was just a fuck-up. Boss man, said Tommy, just up and left. No note or nothing. But like I said, transient community and all, we were used to people leaving. I told Natasha what I thought and she said I was being silly. That I was letting my imagination get the best of me and that I'd best put that imagination to better use like in the bedroom. I kept it to myself from then on out, but people kept dropping off the radar. And I figured I'd better get the fuck out of Dodge before I ended up on that list. I asked Natasha to come with me, but she said no. What am I going to do in a truck besides fuck you? I'm a contortionist, and I don't even have a driver's license. I told her, what? Fucking me ain't good enough gig for you? So I told the boss man I was gonna head on down the road, but as an honorable guy, I'd haul him to the next town on the schedule. I said I'd put out feelers along the way to drivers I knew for a replacement. Natasha got all weepy on me, and I think I felt a little bad for leaving her behind, but I was done with this weirdo parade. I saw Clowny eyeballing me as I set up the rig to head to the next town. He was doing balloon animals for some kids after they applauded him and scurried off to their parents. This motherfucker just stares at me, and then he licks his lips and winks at me. Natasha was right, he was a fucking queer. I gave Clowny the finger and shouted, I don't swing that way, you fudge-nudging creep show. He does this exaggerated belly laugh and skips, not walks, skips over to where I'm standing and does his little dance around me. I'm getting pissed because I don't dig this silly shit. Go do your job, goddammit. I'm not part of your show. He stops and his face turns toward me. It's different than it was when he was with the kids. The eyes, the nose, the mouth. all different. Now he was good, but he couldn't be that good or that quick. I felt my spine stiffen. Not because I was angry or defensive or nothing. This legitimately scared the shit out of me. In fact, if I hadn't had my post-lunch constitution already, I'm pretty sure I might have dropped a few nuggets down my pant leg. Clowny just stood there and smiled. That smile got bigger and bigger until he leaned in and sniffed me, like he was checking me for ripeness or something. I blinked my eyes and shook my head, and he giggled like a girl and skipped away down towards the midway where all the games were. I was shook up a bit by that little confrontation, and I told Natasha about it and told her to be careful after I left because there was definitely something up with Clowny. I drove my allotted load to the next town overnight. We ran as a caravan from location to location, and when we got there, there being just outside the small town of Bethany Beach, Delaware, there weren't a lot of locals, but there were tons of tourists and summer folk to bring to the carnival. I told the boss man I'd stick around until my replacement showed up, which wasn't going to be until the next day. I spent the rest of the afternoon napping and fucking Natasha, and then it was time her first act as the sun was going down, so I just walked around chatting up the people I'd gotten to know over the last few months, getting contact addresses and such so I could keep in touch with the ones I liked, because I'm genial and shit. I kept my eyes peeled for Clowny. He'd really rattled me the day before, and I felt like he'd been sizing me up, and I hadn't passed muster or something. Like I give a horse worn-out pink balloon knot what this shit-stain thought of me. He must have been in for the night because most of the kids were gone, but he wasn't above entertaining the adults. Then I saw her. That fucking redhead. I know it was her. Walking arm in arm with some putz. I caught up with him and I asked her who she was and why she was following us around. The guy she was, well, he didn't take kindly to my scraggly looking ass trying to cut in on his action. He was a big guy. And when I accosted him, he tapped my face with his fist, probably hard enough to send my left testicle. As I looked up from the ground, darkness crept in from the edges of my vision. Before I passed out, the redhead giggled, and I felt fear before I blinked out. I'd heard that giggle before. I came to with a slap to the face from one of the food vendors. I'd been out for a few minutes, and it took me a minute to remember why the fuck I was lying in the middle of one of the walkways between the tents. I got up and brushed myself off. I tried to find the redhead and the big guy again, but no dice. I decided to just get the hell out of public view and wait for Natasha to finish her show. I told her what happened, and she applied a cold compress to my jaw where the guy had co-cocked me. "What do you mean?" she giggled like Clowny. I told her about the confrontation the day before, and she said maybe I imagined it because the guy hit me so hard. I disagreed. It was identical, and I did not imagine it. Clowny McFuckstick was the redhead, or vice versa. Did we even know what it looked like without makeup or the baggy costume? No one I talked to had ever mentioned anything about Clowny's identity. Either way, I was out of there next day and around breakfast time, and no one had heard of anything weird happening the night before. As I drove out of the camp, I passed Natasha's trailer. She was standing on her steps and waving to me, blowing me a kiss. Off to the left of her trailer stood a lone red-headed figure, bare-ass naked. I couldn't quite make out her face, but she was looking in my direction, waving her perky tits. The thing that made me mash the accelerator was her hands. They were wearing massive white clown gloves.